Welcome to Security Nation. Each episode, we talk to security professionals who are taking on big challenges to advance security. I'm Jen Ellis, Vice President of Community and Public Affairs, and I'm your host. In today's episode, we're going to be talking to my good friend Lee Brotherston, who's Director of Security at IoT startup Ecobee. He's going to be talking to us about how you get a security program off the ground and how you get buy-in in startup environments, having worked in a couple. Before we go into that, I'm going to kick the mic over to Todd Beardsley, my co-host and the Director of Research at Rapid7, and all-round good guy. But he's a little frantic this week, so he's going to have a bit of a vent. It's exciting. It's going to be the rapid rundown. Hooray. So, Todd, what are you annoyed about? Tell us everything.
Oh, Jen, I am super riled up. I could not believe my eyes when I saw the news, not once but twice, that Florida City pays off ransomware hooligans.
Was it a Florida man?
It is basically a Florida man story, but for InfoSec. This is insane. So here's the deal. As we're recording this, this was towards the end of last week. Not one, but two Florida townships has now together has paid out about $1 million US in the form of Bitcoin to ransomware criminals.
Oh, your tax dollars at work, people in Florida.
It is super bad news. And here's why. Now, it's easy for me to say, like, never, ever pay the ransom, right? Like, it's not my data.
It is easy. You just said it.
I literally just said it. So super easy for me to say. But, you know, it's not my data. And, you know, maybe they, you know, wang things up when it came to backups and recovery and all that. When you're, you know, dealing with your disaster recovery and, like, let's say a hurricane, which is not, you know, unknown in Florida, swoops in and wipes out all your computers. Like, it would be great if you could just pay the hurricane to restore the stuff, right? But the problem here is that hurricanes are not criminal organizations. They don't have sideline businesses in, like, child sex trafficking and drug distribution and all kinds of other nasty things. And we know that for many criminal organizations that operate on the internet, this is but one of many, you know, untoward things that they are doing to generate revenue here. Also, like, the numbers are astounding. Like, Lake City paid $450,000. Riviera Beach paid over $600,000. And just for context, last year, Atlanta, a, you know, big city in Georgia that people have heard
of. I've heard of Atlanta. Yeah, it's a thing. Yep.
The ransomers last year demanded merely $51,000. So this is like a 10x increase in 1 year. I think it's obvious at this point that, like, these municipalities are emboldening criminals to perform this kind of attack.
I feel like there was a story earlier on this year about a municipality, I can't even say that word, municipality, that got hit by ransomware. They agreed to pay, and the attackers upped the price. They were like, really? Oh, okay, well, in which case, give us $1 million.
It is a very Dr. Evil move, right? And so that's the thing here. Like, when you pay, you don't even know if you're going to get the thing back. You are incidentally, you know, funding other crime.
Here's the problem, though, is, like, going back to your hurricane analogy, like, you can't pay the hurricane to give you your stuff back. Like, if you could, people would do that, right? And so the challenge with that is that there are situations that happen where you have to accept everything's gone, and you try and do what you can to build in some resilience, hopefully. Please, people, if you're not thinking about resilience and continuity, start doing that. That's a good thing to do. But, like, so hopefully you have a plan. If you don't, though, and your data center gets wiped out, there's nothing you can do about it. With attackers, the problem is there is that avenue, and it's really hard to be in a situation where you say, hey, we're just not going to pay. We're not going to go down that route. We're just going to accept the stuff is gone, even though there's an attacker going, but it's not gone. It's right here for you. Okay, we're going to wrap this up. Thank you so much, Todd, for taking us through this. And please, if you are listening out there, resilience, think about how to get ahead of this stuff so you're not left in a situation of relying on insurance and paying out to attackers and funding the bad guys. Although I will say to any bad guys listening, the Hurricane sounds like a great attack group name. You should properly consider it. Let's make that a thing. So for our guest this episode, we're continuing with our tour of the Five Eyes nations. Last episode, we chatted with Ozzy Zaitberg, the head of information security at Indeed.com. If you haven't listened to that episode, do check it out. this week we get a twofer. Who doesn't love a twofer? Hooray, twofer. Not only is our next guest one of my fellow countrymen, albeit a bit northern, he also lives in Canada. So that totally counts as two of the Five Eyes. So apart from his nationality, what can I tell you about this week's guest? Well, firstly, his name is Lee Brotherston. He is the director of security at an IoT startup, Ecobee. I'm sure that he'll tell us a little bit more about Ecobee in a bit. He's also the co-author of the Defensive Security Handbook, published by O'Reilly and co-authored by Amanda Berlin, who I'll hopefully get on the podcast sometime in the future. The book is highly rated. If you haven't checked it out, please do so. And I will now stop plugging his wares for him. He should do that for himself. Please welcome Lee.
Hello, how are you?
I'm peachy. How are you doing this fine day?
I'm great, thank you very much.
Lee, let's get into it a little bit. Let's find out a little bit more about you. Can you just start off by just telling us a little bit about your background and Ecobee and what Ecobee is all about?
Okay. So I'm what I think you would call a security generalist. I haven't focused into a deep niche on, you know, forensics or IR or anything like that. I tend to work mostly on the defense side. I'm currently, like you mentioned, director of security at Ecobee, and we make IoT devices, and that includes the hardware and the firmware and the backend APIs and all that stuff. So I'm kept busy with a lot of different security areas regarding all of that. IoT is an interesting challenge from a security perspective because not many people have to deal with the hardware manufacturer and that kind of thing, along with software and all that side.
Let me ask you some asinine questions just to like really get to know you a bit more. Let's start with one of my favorites, which is, if you weren't doing this, what would you be doing?
I feel like I would like to say that I would be sort of, my metal band would be doing incredibly well. but that may be stretching the imagination somewhat.
I almost spat water over the laptop because of the idea of you in a metal band. Awesome. Yeah, rock on.
Or probably boring office work or something, I guess. I don't know. I can't really imagine myself doing anything else in reality.
What would your metal band be called?
I don't know.
Would it be Murder Dungeon?
That would be a fantastic name. For reasons.
There is a backstory here. We're not sharing it. unless you're the authorities, in which case, please contact us.
I'm so glad my attorney is in the room.
Your attorney is always in the room, which worries me a little bit. all right, fantastic. Lee, if you could only take one food to your desert island, I don't know why you have a desert island, but if you had a desert island and you could only take one food, why? What would it be?
Everyone would say carrot cake because
I'm sorry, everyone would say carrot cake?
Everyone would say that I would say carrot cake.
Right, I was going to say, I'm not taking carrot cake.
I am kind of known for being a bit obsessive about carrot cake, although that I don't think that works well on a desert island. I don't feel like the nice frosting would keep real. But I may be overthinking this question a little.
Is the carrot cake just a vehicle for the frosting?
It's always just a vehicle for the frosting. Carrot cake without frosting is not carrot cake.
Awesome. So you're going to take sweaty carrot cake to your desert island.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, presumably, if you can own a desert island, you also can buy a refrigerator, hopefully.
Oh, I was thinking sort of stranded, but yeah.
I guess if you're stranded, do you really have the chance to be like, I want the carrot cake? I refuse to be shipwrecked without the carrot cake.
Okay, fine.
I was thinking more of a Branson thing. Apparently, I'm going for like a full-on British flavor for this particular episode. So I was going more for like a Richard Branson, own your own island ridiculousness thing.
Right. What would you take?
Oh, God, I have no idea. A personal chef. I wouldn't eat the chef, just
would
to be clear.
Technically count as food.
Okay, fair. I don't know. What food do I really love eating? Todd, what would you take? I'm just going to defer.
I, you know, like,
I'm a hacker, so obviously I'm going to try to trick the genie who's granting this wish into giving me, like, I don't know, like a yacht-sized waffle so I could leave.
A waffle seems like a bad option for something to get out of there on, though.
No, but really big. You know, sure, I have to be able to eat it eventually.
But it still has holes.
Not all the way through. The holes in the bottom, like, create balance. I feel like the waffle is the most seaworthy.
Do you know how boats work?
Of food. Yes.
All right. Okay, I'm trying to think now, like, what I would go for that was, like, boat-sized, that I think you could actually reasonably make it out of there in. Like, something that's definitely not very soluble. Like, what if you asked for...
beef jerky.
Perfect. Right? You could make it into a raft. A raft of beef jerky. And if that didn't work out for you, you'd still have beef jerky to eat for a long time. And it doesn't go off.
Correct.
Perfect. okay. So, Salih, I was going to ask you what your top tip is for creating your own murder dungeon, but we'll leave it at this. I think we've asked enough, Kate, to know your question.
Okay. Okay.
How did you get into security, though?
So my kind of backstory is I did the usual thing, going and doing like some technology-related bachelor's degree at university, and then I went and got a tech support job at an ISP, well, tech support slash sysadmin slash network engineer, as these things kind of work out. And this was sort of mid to late 90s, so there weren't really security degrees and such like to go and get. And then it was just like a case of I'd always been interested in security kind of on the side. And then one day a customer had a security issue and needed some help, and I helped them out. And then the people that ran the help desk were like, oh, well, that's useful. We can sell that. So I went and helped out like another customer that had an issue and so on. And then it just kind of escalated. They got bought and by another company, and I started up the security team at that company. And then it's, you know, once you're in security, you're in. It's just moving roles within the industry as the years have gone on after that.
I like that that idea that once you're in, you're in. I'm not sure if I buy that, but...
It's like the mafia. There's no InfoSec.
Once you're in, there's no escape. Oh, dear. Right.
InfoSec John Wick. Like...
Oh, my God. This actually makes perfect sense. Okay. Excellent. So when did you join Ecobee?
I've only been here since October. I say only in sort of the smaller startup land. That's like quite a lot of time. but yeah, since October.
And prior to that, you were, where were you?
I was at a fintech startup, also in Toronto.
And you were doing a similar role there?
Yeah, I was also director of security in that role. Once again, it's sort of looking after absolutely everything on the defense side, except for they didn't make hardware. But they did have to deal with money. So that was another fun thing.
So you've got like a good amount of experience now of going into startups. It sounds like fairly early stage startups and, you know, sort of building security from the ground up. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, the last couple of jobs have definitely been that. And there's been sort of hints of that earlier in my career as well.
So... can we talk about that? Can we get into the details on how you
yes,
go about that? So, like,
definitely.
You get there, you land, you get started. What do you do? Like, how do you think about this from the start?
I think the first thing is you need to understand a bunch of things about the business. And some of it is very auditory, gap analysis-y kind of stuff. So, you know, looking at what they do today and in line with their business, where they should be, so you can see where the difference is and what they need to work on. So a lot of that is, you know, it depends on the industry. So, for example, at the fintech, a certain amount comes from regulation because, you know, financial services companies are regulated. There are certain minimum bars by law that they have to reach. Some are not. Like in my current role, you know, we obviously have to adhere to compliance around electrical safety standards, but less so around things like, you know, software and security and stuff. So I think, yeah, first of all...
which might change in the future.
Oh, it may well change in the future, but today, yes.
Yeah.
So it's going in and seeing where the gaps are. And some of that comes with the business. So it's like, what is most important to them? Is it protecting the customers' accounts that log on? Is it protecting their intellectual property? Is it, is it uptime and availability? It's a lot easier to get buy-in to protect the things that are most important to the company. You also want to prioritize what you're protecting. And then it's sort of, looking at the maturity levels in each of those areas. So what do you think has the most appropriate controls in place? Do you have policies that you need? Sort of, it's almost like walking through like the ISO standards or something and going like, which boxes of these do we tick and not tick? And then it's mostly a case of prioritizing the unticked boxes, exactly which ones you want to fix first and sort of how hard you want to go at that. Because, you don't need to achieve full maximum security in every area. I mean, it would be nice, but there's time and resources.
Yeah, not astonishingly realistic, yeah. how do you deal with the sort of chicken and egg problem of like you need to build capability, you have limited resources, you have limited budget? I mean, do you think about outsourcing? Do you think about like staffing up first? Do you think about taking on some projects that you can create as wins to demonstrate the value to the business and then staffing? Like, how do you think about all of this stuff?
I mean, my personal view is, going in with a quick win. It doesn't even have to be a big win, but just to demonstrate that, that there is value in doing this. I think with regards to the staffing, you often are forced one way or the other. So, hiring's hard, and hiring for security is, really hard and super competitive. So sometimes you may be forced to outsource or get contractors or what have you. So it may be forced that way. My general view is if there isn't something forcing you that way, I would prefer to take someone in-house for any task that's likely to be ongoing. So being a general security engineer, for example, but to outsource something that might be a one-time piece of project work or something like that, that requires specialist skills. I mean, the prime example of that is tend to outsource pen testing. We don't have a requirement for full-time penetration testing, but when we do need it, we want to get a specialist in, so they come and do that. But we try and do things like internal tool development and things like that in-house. It works out a lot better in multiple areas. I think in the long term, that probably works out cheaper. It's also, someone that is familiar with the business, has a long-term interest in it, that sort of thing. So I think it's a good thing overall.
How do you, we talked about resources are sometimes constrained and it's sort of a thing that's thrust upon you. And I think, if you're going in early stage, I mean, presumably the business has recognized that it needs to do something in terms of security by the very fact that it's hired you. But how do you get real organizational buy-in? Like, you're going to go in and maybe, somebody in the leadership has decided we need security, but that doesn't mean that the engineering team is on board. It doesn't mean that the IT team is on board. Like, how are you getting buy-in from all of these different parts of the
organization? Right. Gotcha. Yeah. It's the, we should do a security. We don't know what a security looks like, but we should do that.
That thing there, that's the thing we should do.
Yeah, we should tick that box. I think the main thing is, there's a couple of areas. It's firstly sort of making it clear that this isn't just a ticky box to tick a box thing. It's really to drive real benefit. And I think people appreciate it when you can show that there's real benefit. And I think more and more it's the case that you can't go in and be like security teams used to be the gatekeeper who's, the job is to come in and say no at architectural review to everything and like annoy everyone. It's more to work with people and sort of deliver some value. And there is a certain amount of politics in that. I think doing things like things that are super visible are good to do occasionally, just because it makes people see that security is being considered and handled. So like a prime example for letting customers see it is going into a company and enabling 2FA and making sure all their web properties are on SSL or TLS really. But, but things like that is like they're visible to the outside world and it gives them a feeling of trust and that sort of thing. And it demonstrates some instant value to the business because most companies that I've worked with have a requirement on customers to trust you. At a fintech, they want you to give you your money, give you their money to look after and to grow. And they obviously don't want that to disappear somewhere. And similarly, I'm at an IoT company now, and we want people to plug devices into their house. And so both of those require trust. So, you know, building customer trust through through enabling the business and providing features is a great way of doing things. And I think another thing is sort of empowering. A number of people talk about pushing security left, which I think is a really useful way of demonstrating value. So rather than being the person that comes in and like code audits and goes, you did it wrong here, here and here, go fix the thing. Going in and doing things like training developers how to not do it wrong in the first place and getting them on board with it. It's a case of, you know, getting things done earlier in the cycle. It once embedded, it makes things quicker because retrofitting anything is always more painful than doing it right in the first place. And it does tend to lead to less repeat mistakes. Once someone's accidentally caused a cross-site scripting or SQL injection or whatever, and you've gone and explained to them why and how and all that sort of thing, like they're less likely to make the same mistake again. So I think that it's generally like this whole, I'm going to break out all the cliches, but it's the whole be an enabler, work with the business, sort of, you know, do things to help. You know, instead of saying you can never ever send files externally because security, you know, helping people come up with the right way to share files externally, because that way they're not going to be sidestepping you and all that sort of thing. And I think people just generally appreciate that attitude of like of helping rather than being the big bad. I said no. Yeah.
So Lee, is that the kind of, so you said specifically, that you want to be able to enable developers to, you know, do secure coding rather than like fixing it after the fact. Is that the kind of thing you find yourself doing like as much as you want, or do you want to do more of that in your current position or what? Cause like, I, you know, in my experience, security people are like, okay, developers, you know, they tend to be at the level of, you know, amateur developers, yeah, but like super great hackers, right? Like, you know, to be a good security person, you have to know like 50 different languages. To be a developer, you only have to know 30, right? So,
right.
So I'm curious, like, right, how that dynamic works, because you also mentioned like building trust first and then, you know, and doing that. So I'm just curious, like, how successful are you at that? And do you want to, like, are you as successful as you want to be?
I'm never as successful as I want to be. Security is one of those never done tasks. but yeah, I mean, I fall into that boat you described of like, I can code because I've had to clutch tools together or whatever, but I code like a security person codes. I don't think about things like scaling in quite the way that a developer thinks about systems scaling out and that sort of thing. I think some of it is what you said about that. A lot of the time, security people are like, ugh, developers don't know anything, silly developer writing SQL injection. Meanwhile,
the developers, right, and it's like, unfair too, because yeah, it's not like the developers are, you know, evil or stupid or children, right, you know, it's like they just, and it's not even so much that they're ignorant. It's just that, like,
those are your three buckets, evil, stupid,
those are my buckets. Right. You know, but no, but I'm serious. Like, developers want to do the right thing, right? Right. Like, and you, so, like, I go and talk at developer conferences every once in a while about security, and usually, you know, that you know tends to generate like the aha moment in the audience, right, about something about like how SQL injection works, like under the covers, and like, right, they are, in my experience, they're very desperate to want to know this stuff and want to know how to do, right, it, how, yeah, to do it well. So like, I think that's, you know, it's conversely like a thing that security teams don't do a ton of, right, and it's where they get the most bang for their buck.
Yeah, I mean, I think.
Do you agree?
Sorry, yeah, yes, I do. I mean, I think that stuff works well because one of the things I find is that like doing security stuff, not talking technology like, you know, like firewalls or whatever, but like it doesn't scale. It's anything that's like manual code review or whatever, you can only throw people at it for so long. So. Sure. You need to scale it, and getting other people to help with that helps scale it. And you're right. I think like the aha moment is something that's great. Like I've done things like give people, I forget what it's called. Is it damn vulnerable web server or whatever? The one that's got a bunch of vulnerabilities in it, and show people how to break into it. And once they've done it a couple of times, I think they get like quite excited about that and start thinking about stuff a little more.
And then you recruit them to the security team.
I may have done. The other thing that we've had quite a lot of luck with is running bug bounties and finding that when the reports come in, we don't have the security team just go and fix it and raise a pull request or whatever. We actually put it into the backlog of the relevant development team and go and work with them on fixing it. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like a learning experience as they go through that. And I think that sort of also helps because that's then no longer the internal security guy being the tinfoil hat wary guy who's like, you can't do that. Like, this is a real world external person has gone like, look, I did a thing and you didn't, and I didn't have access to the source code and I just found it. And I think that carries a lot of weight with people. And like you said, like developers, not silly. They, you know, they understand the ramifications of like authentication bypass or something. So I think it goes down really well with them when they can be involved in that sort of stuff.
I mean, I think, you know, what you're both talking about at core is like, you know, when it comes to collaboration and colleagues, not assuming bad intent and recognizing that people have areas of expertise. Those areas of expertise may not be the same, but that's a great opportunity for you to learn from each other. And if you can come to the table with a little bit of humility and treat others with respect, then probably you'll get a lot further along the road in getting buy-in and finding ways to work together.
Right.
Treat other people as you'd like to be treated should be a pretty basic thing, I think.
Right, exactly.
Not to get all preachy and all monkey.
No, I agree. I think the other thing as well that I forgot to mention in that is also giving some idea of priority to people. Because when everything's a fire, nothing's a fire. I think if you come in with like the attitude of like, hey, there's this bug, it needs to be fixed, but it's not super bad. You know, if you can do it in the next couple of months, that'd be great. You've got a lot more sort of social capital when you walk in and go, like, drop everything. The bad thing has happened. The bad thing.
Yes, and hopefully you've done some tabletops by this time to prepare people for what it's like when the bad thing happens. So it all sounds like very much like everything's going swimmingly, but we all know the real world's not quite like that, and you wouldn't need a merger dungeon if it was. So what are some of the challenges that you have encountered as you've been building?
Right. So there's a few things. One of them is what we kind of touched on already, hiring. Hiring's hard and it's time consuming, and it's even more time consuming when you use that time and you don't get anywhere. So that's one thing. I think the initial getting business buy-in, like security rarely makes life easier for anyone. I mean, it makes things better, but it's always like, it's an extra click or something takes a few more CPU cycles or, you know, there's an extra gate to go through or whatever. So, you know, getting people sort of bought into it can be a challenge. And that's definitely one of them. And I think also sometimes convincing leadership that it's the right thing to do can be more difficult than you think. Because like you said, you've got the tick box, the we should do a security, we've hired you, do the security. But sometimes I think because people don't know what that looks like, they're not always prepared for you to come in and go deliver some difficult message around like, okay, you want to do a security? Well, this is the awkward thing you now have to do. They have a bunch of priorities, especially in startups or sort of small to medium businesses where there's an onus on shipping now and moving fast and only slightly breaking things and all that kind of stuff. By virtue of that, you know, trying to get priority to go like, hey, can you stop making product and fix this bug that like four people are going to notice is sometimes a hard sell. And, you know, I think there's a certain amount of realism and pragmatism has to come along with things. I think I suffer from something that probably most security people do is like, you want to fix everything. And actually, it's a challenge to like narrow it down because when you're a one-person team or there's like you and you've got like two people working for you or something of that sort of size, you definitely can't go and touch everything. you can barely do high level management of everything. So there is very much prioritizing and having your prioritize list aligned with everyone else's prioritize list.
What would be the piece of advice you would give yourself? You know, if you're going back in time to when you went to your first startup, what would you tell yourself to do or think about?
I think that early mistakes are to go in thinking of things all from a security perspective or a technology perspective. And actually understanding what people's core business objectives is actually a really good way to make sure you're focusing on the right things that are A, going to resonate with other people, and B, you know, be accepted for funding or resourcing or whatever else. So yeah, learning the business and how to express that to other people, because not everyone wants CVSS scores. sometimes people just want to know how big's the fine going to be or what have you.
I can tell you that no one wants CVSS scores.
But yeah, nobody is disputing this.
True. Bad example.
But yeah, I mean, figuring out the commonality and focusing on that is great advice, yeah. I think. Figuring out how to speak in a language that people care about.
Right, yeah. I mean, a lot of small companies are, you know, if they're venture capital backed, they're probably looking for specific growth numbers. They're probably also having to explain their spending and things like that. So being able to leverage that by understanding it is good.
Yeah, I'm into that. Todd, anything that you want to ask Lee?
I'm good.
Yeah, you now that you've had a ticket CVSS, you feel like everything has been
mission accomplished.
Mission is complete.
I do feel like before we let Lee go that I should just clarify to anybody listening, particularly in law enforcement, that Lee does not, in fact, have a merger dungeon, as far as I know. No. The last time that we did a call with him, it looked very much as if he might from the background. And we therefore spent much of the time on the call, rather than talking about security things, speculating over why there was a very strange shower curtain hanging up behind him in his basement. So, yes, I presume that Lee is not, in fact, a murderer.
Great. Well, that clears things up.
I presume he's not a murderer. I cannot say for certain, but I presume.
Jen, we don't have to qualify it anymore.
No, you think he's done?
No, I think we're good.
I just don't want to get implicated in this, you know.
Right.
All right. I will just say thank you very much, Lee. I appreciate it. You have a great story, and it's great to hear from people who are building from scratch. We would love to have you on again sometime in the future, no doubt.
I would love to. That'd be great. Thank you for having me.
Cheers, Lee.
See ya.
Bye. So that's our episode. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks to our special guest, Lee Brotherston, my amazing co-pilot, Todd Beardsley, my amazingly ranty co-pilot. And most of all, thanks to the woman behind the scenes. She is the Wizard of Oz. She makes it all happen. Bree Hand, who is our producer, and basically the most patient person on the planet, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
if you like the podcast, please do subscribe. We release episodes every 2 weeks, so the next one will be out on Friday, July 19th. We will be speaking with yet another Brit.
Oh, jolly good.
I promise it's a real person and not just Todd speaking with a British accent, although maybe that's a thing we can do in the future. In fact, we're going to be talking to David Rogers, who is an amazing chap. He wrote, amongst many other things that he's done, he wrote the UK Code of Practice for Consumer IoT Security. Check it out if you're not familiar with it. It's very good. And it is so good, in fact, and such an impressive piece of work that he has been recognized by the Queen, the actual Queen, the one in England with the crown and stuff, dropped out of a helicopter during the Olympics. You know who I mean. So we're going to have him on next week, so don't miss it. Thanks very much.